45 minutes.
Okay.
Set 9:30.
It's therapist time, 1 hour would be like 45 minutes or so. I mentioned I'm an alcoholic.
Just in case.
Oh, thank you. Welcome if you're new. Please read the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I just want to welcome you to this volunteer organization. We have no hostages here. Everybody's a volunteer. You can come and go as you please. Welcome to do that. Try to behave yourself if you can. Get sober for a little while. You might even pick up after yourself. Pretty good deal we got going on here. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous after a couple of drunk drivings, and I didn't look like I look now. It was before, you know, cell phones and internet and all those things. And I never got to get on the internet and find a meeting when I was new. I had to use 2 dimes to call my sponsor. I love to say those kind of things. Right? It was a little bit ago. And I hate it when people sit up here and they don't tell you how much time they got. So I got sober November 30th, 1987. I had hair down to my shoulders. I had a big old beard. My greatest form of denial was working out at the gym. I wasn't that bad as long as I could make gym. I got so sick with going to the gym that I would call in sick at work to prove that I was still healthy. And go to the gym for 6 or 7 hours a day. Just keep driving iron like I'm insane. And just so I could pretend that I was okay. Because I was never okay. I was never okay. I'd get up in the morning, light a joint, try to get to the liquor store. But it was always that dilemma in the morning for me personally that I had to be at work before 6. And in this state, they don't sell alcohol before 6. And I know the humiliation of begging the guy behind the check stand to please sell me a couple beers so I could get to work. And I was 23. And I thought that was just perfectly okay. He's like, wow, because everybody else is a bigger problem than me. I cause problems. I don't have a problem. I'm one of those humble guys. I'd like to tout myself as a troublemaker until I get in trouble, and then I turn into kind of a whimpering, pathetic dude who wants somebody to get me out of it. Somebody else get me out of this, because I can't, because they don't just let me come and go as I please. They just want to keep me a while till somebody, I could be under somebody else's supervision. And thank you all, you Al-Anon people, for supervising me long enough. It's probably saved my life. Probably saved my life. People who were codependent enough to put up with what I was doing, making sure that I got fed and tolerating me when I went to sleep and pissed on myself and all of those things that you fortunate people get to go through. It's like, what an awesome level of humility that I still don't comprehend. It's like putting up with an alcoholic. I got a couple of alcoholic kids, and I'm not nearly humble enough to go to Al-Anon. I'd rather kill him. You know what I'm saying? Just saying, somebody's got to do something with the pain of going with an alcoholic. And then I totally understand, like, yeah, just stab him. That'd be good. So, you know, my illustrious drinking career was totally average, totally, you know, high school-y, junior high school-y, gonna go out with the boys, gonna drink and prove that we were bigger boys than we thought we were, and prove to ourselves that we were something by the way we drank. And, you know, by the time we were early teens, we were already bragging about how we could drink our dads under the table, because, you know, my alcoholism is filled with egotism. I mean, there's a big identity with me and drinking. And for some of you younger guys, you know about when the Raiders are on TV selling light beer from Miller. It tastes great, less filling. And I just would try to always imitate these things to try to make myself feel like somebody. I'd see the next thing. What was the next? It got bad for, you know, for a while there. I had matching 357 pistols, and I thought I was Yosemite Sam. Because I had a big old beard and long hair. Yeah, yeehaw. And that kind of fantasy life was a life that I was creating all of the time for myself. No matter how successful I was at the things I was doing, no matter how well I did at anything, I still had this other thing going on all the time where I had to be something more than whatever the heck it was I thought I was. And I wasn't that bad. You know, I'm not the big, you know, gangster guy that's so popular here about these days. I'm just like a guy who goes to work and does a bunch of drugs. And I think cocaine is for women and men should always do meth. Because that's what real men do. Right? Those are the kind of standards I create. I got to the point where I was the lower companion that people were seeking. You know, for those of you who don't know about that, there's a part of our book that talks about seeking lower companions. So I want to hang around with derelicts so I can feel better about myself. If I can just hang around with this person who's a bigger loser than me, then I feel good about me. And I was the guy they were looking to hang out with for a while. I got there. I made it. So I drank myself into alcoholism. I just kept drinking, and I kept drinking, and I never thought that drinking too much was drinking too much. I didn't think blackouts were a big deal. I thought it was just part of it. It was just an average thing I was doing. Hanging out with the fellas, having a good time, rocking it, hoping to get to be drinking age so I could go to a bar on my 21st birthday. And found out that I could go to bars at 17 and hang out at 17. As a guy who, you know, in high school, they come to your house, they want you to go buy them alcohol. I'm that guy. Had a full beard and stuff. And so I, alcohol was quickly becoming the center of my existence. Whether I was drinking it, buying it, getting over it, looking to get some more, whatever. And by the time I was done with high school, I was full-blown daily drinker. Didn't even think like this isn't even a problem. It's just like, because I love beer. I love beer. And I drink other hard alcohol to enhance my beer effects. Right? Until that takes over, and then I have to do like meth, and that gets me too wired. Then I got to drink pot, smoke pot. Before it was medicine, so I got to have fun smoking pot. I didn't have to be all serious about smoking pot. I could have fun with it. Didn't have to. We called it by cool names. I feel sorry for young people these days. You know, they're never going to have Acapulco Gold. They'll never have Panama Red. Pot in California got to be too good. So I started getting smarter economically. You know, I figured things out. Like, if I became the man, the dealer, the guy, I could save some money. Because that was a big concern of mine. Saving money, because if I had more money, guess what I'm going to do with more money? I'm going to go out drinking, and to make myself popular, I'm going to buy you guys drinks too. I like doing that. Everybody look at me as the guy who had the money to buy them drinks. I was going to try to find some way to make myself popular, some way to belong, a way to fit in. I needed a position. I needed some prestige from my existence. And I struggled and strived to do that a lot. You know, if I did anything, I had to be the best at it. So if I had a gym, I had to be the strongest guy at the gym. And if I did anything else, I had to be better than you. And as humble as I am, I have to make sure that you know that. And what is included with that is, and then you have to admit it to me. That is one hostile dude. When I got to the point of drinking that I had to make sure that people validated me by telling me how superior I was to them, I was overboard antisocial. I was not somebody that you would invite over to your house anymore. It's like my friends would go like, I'd have to promise them because I'm pathetic when I'm like super macho, right? Okay, man, I won't drink. Just let me come over and be with everybody because I'm a lonely, alcoholic person. I just won't drink, man. Come on, let me come over for whatever, Easter, gin fizzes, whatever it was. And I started having to beg people to let me come over to the people that were my friends. There one time I was a popular center of attention, loving guy to this, come on, man, let me come over. It's like that loneliness was devastating. That despair was devastating. And I had enough ego to not be able to admit it to anyone. I was egotistical enough that I could not tell anybody how devastated I was when they said, no. No, man. You've done enough. Can't come over. We don't believe you when you say you're not going to drink. Because what was confusing for me at the time was that I thought when I told them that I wasn't going to drink, that I wasn't going to drink. I didn't know that I had crossed over into full-blown alcoholism. I just thought that sometimes I got carried away. And I thought I was going to be able to tell somebody, I'm not going to drink. And I'd be able to do it. I wasn't lying when I said it, but my actions made a liar out of me all of the time. Or I really love the ones like, I'll only have a couple. I'll only have a couple. I'll be just fine. And I wasn't kidding. I was not kidding. Then all of a sudden I'm drunk. And I'm wondering to myself, because I can't tell anybody that this is going on, because otherwise, because that'll ruin my cool. Because you know you need to tell me that I'm cooler than you. So I can't tell anybody how uncool I'm not. I couldn't tell anybody that I have no idea why I was drinking. I didn't mean to. I would never let anybody know that I was that out of control. I didn't mean to. It was like, that was like way too much cowardice or something for in my thinking that I could not tell anybody anything like that. So the loneliness of alcoholism was setting in. It was setting in and I was 20. And I'm just getting more and more trying to figure it out, trying to cover it up, trying to figure out how to cover it up, trying to find the right combinations of all the things that we can combine things with to be able to make it to the party. Before I was 20 years old, my friends used to pick me up. I was already too loaded to get to the party. Sometimes they'd throw me in the car, and then they'd carry me in the party and throw me on a bed at the party and leave me there. And then they'd pick me back up and take me home. At least I could say I was at the party. These were merciful people to me. Hey, yeah. Yeah, we went out. You know, and I had some pride over the fact that I went out Friday night, right? But I didn't do anything. It's like I was hammered. And I had no way to not do it. And when I was alone, waking up in the morning, shaking, and seeing who I was waking up with this time, and man, I could not believe these poor people who would like hang out with me. Because I was a mess. I was a mess. But I couldn't think like this. If you were willing to hang out with me, you were a mess too. I thought it was all me. The self-centeredness of my alcoholism kept me from seeing anything clearly. So I couldn't really see that anybody that hung out with me had to be a real piece of work. Had to be a real piece of work. You could go home with a guy like me. Because I didn't go home like not wasted. I mean, I got home a lot of times. I don't know how I got home. And I brought somebody with me. It's like, I don't know what shape they were in. I don't know what shape they were in, but it could not have been good. So I get arrested, and as arrests go, wasn't a big deal. All my good codependent alcoholic friends who had all the diseases, you know, they're all, dude, bad luck. Don't worry about it. Unfortunate case of bad circumstances. And we bolster each other up to get back out there and go do it again. Yeah, that was unfortunate. Too bad. Yeah, it won't happen again. Now, there's nothing in my being that said it would not happen again. Because I drank every day. By the time I was in my early 20s, I drank from the time I got up until the time I went to bed and figured out how to get too wired so I could come down with some and smoke too much pot to drink too much some more before I got tired enough from all of that to go to sleep. And then I do it again in the morning. I don't know about you, a kind of alcoholics, but I'm the kind of alcoholic that tries to save like a couple lines in the morning to be able to get to the liquor store. And when that is too much, then I gotta have a joint to go with it to get to the liquor store. And so when I was getting closer to the end, I got arrested and all these important, I had to go to like 6 alcohol awareness classes. I think the drunk driving cost me, I like to say this because the drunk driving cost me like $400, right? No lawyer, plead guilty, $400. I know you guys are getting busted today. It sucks, boy. It sucks. That's why I like to make fun of the new guys who are getting drunk and getting drunk driving now. Because it was cheap to get busted back in those days. You guys get busted now, they just put the screws to you. And as I continued on and coming out of being arrested, I got 6 alcohol awareness classes. And in these alcohol awareness classes, at the last one, some members from the PICPC committee, public information in cooperation with the professional community people, they came in, and this lady says, an alcoholic is a person who has lost the ability to control their drinking. And I'm like, huh? What? And being a good alcoholic, she repeated herself a few times. So I remembered it. It's like a person who had lost the ability to control their drinking. I never thought about controlling my drinking. I've done controlled drinking by then, but I didn't think that's what I was doing. I didn't think when I would, you know, just try to leave a beer in the refrigerator was controlled drinking. I didn't know I was doing it, but I had a name for it now. I'm trying to control my drinking. So then I tried to control my drinking. And I left the drunk driving courses and I went down to the corner deli and I got a couple of beers and walked home. Because that's what I did. And I started this controlled drinking thing. And she said one other thing that I thought was cute. Right? If you can't stay out of jail for the duration of your probation. So I had like a measuring tool now, right? All I got to do. I see there's some other guys who think like I think. All I have to do is stay out of jail for the duration. It didn't say quit drinking. It just said stay out of jail. And I'm thinking like this is pretty low standards right here. This ought to be easy. Now remember, I'm drinking on the way to work in the morning. I stop out after work. I stop by. I drink on the way home. I'm always in the car with a beer between my legs. Always. Calling sick at work to go around, put a case of beer in the front seat of the car to go driving around the county and drink. And I'm thinking, because I'm sane, I'm going to not have to go to jail again. I could do this. I did nothing to even try to do it. I was so powerless over alcohol by this time that I had no plan in place of how I was going to stay out of jail. I just thought, because I said so. I said so. How are you going to stay out of jail? I said I wasn't going to go. Ha ha. I thought that was going to work. I had no plan for failure. I had none at all. I was just, okay, this would be a good couple years later. I'll be on my way. And I made it a year and a half. Did it again. Whoosh. Off they took me again. And the only difference was this time, I knew they were right. I knew that I was dangerous. I knew that I was a harm to society, that they were protecting society from people like me. They did not get the wrong guy. They got exactly the right guy. And on my arrest report, when they asked me whatever they asked me, the answer they put down on my arrest report was this. Well, I was a lot more wasted the last time you guys arrested me. Right? It wasn't like I didn't do it or I only had a couple. It was like, I'm not that bad. And I think that's a reasonable response to being in handcuffs in the backseat of a car. And like, yeah, I'm not that bad. So regardless of my personal experience and what was occurring in the moment, my mind was so toasted that I sat there and thought somehow this was like good thinking still. Like, yeah, I'm not that bad, really. Yeah, I'm dangerous, and yeah, I could like kill people's kids, and yeah, blah, 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 yeah, but I'm not that bad. That kind of denial. And when I was sitting in jail, because they put me in this jail cell that had a cement floor and a hole in it. I don't know why they chose that cell for me. It was not comfortable. It should have been nicer. I don't know why they thought I would hurt myself. I love myself. I'm not one of those self-loathing alcoholic guys. I'm better than you alcoholic guy. I didn't come here with like loads of low self-esteem and stuff. I came here cocky. So I'm sitting there and these words came out of my face, and I have no idea how this happens. But I'm hoping if you're new that you've had this moment, because it could save your life forever. God help me. I'm sitting on the floor in jail and out of my mouth. No plan. I wasn't going, okay, now I'm going to pray like a good little boy. None of that shit was going on. I'm sitting there listening to some jerk in the next cell singing Panama, you know, whoever those guys were. Panama! Bleh. That guy's worse than me. Right? That's how I think. Oh, God, at least I'm not that bad. But out of my mouth comes, God help me. And it's like, and I heard myself say it. It kind of messed me up mentally. It was not like relief. It was like, what the hell happened? Huh. And what ended up happening for me was I got out of jail and I went to the cocaine dealer. I brought a six pack like I always do. Did some cocaine, smoked some weed, drank some beer. And he turned me on to a lawyer. And the lawyer sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is January 1985. And I knew I was done drinking. I'm sitting here with beer and pot and cocaine. I'm done drinking. That's how insane I was when I was hit at that time. While I'm drinking, I'm thinking I don't drink anymore. That's a lack of familiarity, I think. How does that happen? What kind of insanity is that? If you want to talk step two stuff, it's like, that's insane. The very thing I'm doing in the moment, I'm pretending I'm not doing. So I swore off alcohol again. And March, I had my last drink. I went golfing with my brother. Me and my brother are fairly competitive. So I'm 25, 26 years old now. And I kicked his ass in golf. Kicked his ass. Proud as hell about that. Again, I kicked his ass in golf. Not bragging up here, I'm just saying. I walked off the 18th and went right into the bar and started drinking. Couple months, not drinking. That was the first night I came to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Went back over, this is in Hidden Valley, Lake County, and I went back over into Sonoma County, and I went to an AA meeting for the first time. I haven't drank since then. I sat there, I introduced myself as a newcomer. I never did that again either. You guys who stand up and introduce yourself as newcomers, like you are way braver and tougher and humbler and everything else. It was so embarrassing. It was so humiliating. It was so degrading. I don't care if my life depended on it. I wasn't doing it. I was not doing that. I am not going to sit there, stand up, and have everybody turn around and look at me. Well, I'm an alcoholic. Because that whole room turned around. Right? I'm going like, what the hell? And for one of the first times in a long time, I felt like all these people saw me. Like, oh shit, I'm found out. Pardon my language. I'm found out. They know. And I heard the speaker, and the speaker's a Native American friend of mine, and she was, I grew up with a Native American grandmother, and she, alcoholics, Native Americans don't drink, or they're gonna become alcoholic. That's how I was raised, and I drank anyway, and I became an alcoholic. And so she shared, and here was a sober Native person, and I go like, well, shit, I can do this. I can do this. If a Native could get sober, I can get sober. I know there's lots of prejudices and bias behind all that, but, you know, too bad. It's true. And I started coming to meetings. And I was trying to get along with people. And all these people were like you guys are, right? You guys here are out in the lobby and they're all happy and they're hugging each other. And I'm just going like, oh my God, there is no way I'm doing this. I mean, hugging in AA meetings was just becoming a thing. People still shook hands a lot back then, but there were some huggers coming around. And I was just like, no, get off me. Right? And then they're happy. And I knew that these people could not understand what it was like for me. The self-centeredness of my disease almost took me right out of here. Because you could not possibly understand what it was like for me if you were happy. Because I was not happy. I was miserable. I was angry. I had sorrow buried in it that I could not let anybody know about. And I'm going to these meetings and these people are laughing. And they looked like they liked each other. Like they were friendly. You know, they like bring you cookies and things. Have you had any coffee yet? It's like they're being polite. I don't know when the last time I was around polite people, but these people were being polite, and I'm just freaked out. Like, oh no. Very back in those days, they were pretty. If you swore in a meeting, they let you know it wasn't cool. I'll just say it like that. If you swore in a meeting, they let you know that isn't cool here, man. You could do better than that. It wasn't like a shame on you thing. It was an expectation of doing better. And so I didn't stop me. I got just so you know. I had a little ways to go. I still had a few defects of character I had to have removed. And so I started going to more and more meetings around. I found this old-timer meeting. It was a Wednesday night Windsor group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And these guys were old. Now, if you're a young guy right now and you're looking at me, they were this old. You know what I'm saying? It's hard to get that, like, I had hair down to my shoulders and a big old beard and stuff. It's like, when these guys said that they had, like, 20, 30 years, back then I could not picture that this cat with 30 years is sitting there like what he looked 30 years ago. Like, he's probably a handsome son of a gun, that guy, 30 years ago. Now, I didn't just look like an old man. Now I look like an old man. I'm just one of those old man guys, you know, hair in my ears and stuff. And these guys were calm and they were peaceful. And they would come up and they would calmly say things like, welcome. You would have messed me up, just say that. Welcome. Put your hand out. We'd shake hands. I'd go get some cookies. Or at that meeting, they could put out the cups of hard candy for the alcoholic in withdrawal. And sit down and listen. He said, when you've listened long enough, maybe you'll find someone that you might want to work with. I had no idea what they were talking about, want to work with. It took me a couple of years of not drinking before I realized that how it works is how it works. Hey, read it every meeting. How it works. I don't have anything in a person that blah, blah, blah. I heard it for a couple of years. But how it worked for me was, I got to go golfing more, I got to go to gym more, and I should quit smoking cigarettes. That's what I was making up my program of action to stay sober, was I was just making this stuff up because things in meetings weren't registering in this brain of mine that was fried. I didn't know how bad I was when I got here. I had no idea. And I kept hearing them, and I kept trying. And the first time I shared at a meeting, I hadn't done anything, any of the things. I hadn't done the deal, like they like to say these days. And this old lady, Maria, she comes up and she hands me a big book. And she just says things like, you know, before you share again, maybe you want to read this book. Because I was spitting out my best AA stuff at that meeting. I'm telling you, this was cool stuff I was saying, and they should have all stayed sober 5 years for hearing it. That's how I'm thinking, because I'm super humble. And she comes up, and the humiliation of that moment was like, oh. But it was that humiliation of that moment that got me into the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I still have that book. I still have that book with my sobriety date in it. And I started reading the book. And all these smart people in AA started not looking so smart anymore. I thought they were like, these guys would say these things and it'd be so something that I'd feel some feelings and wow, this guy must be spiritual or something. And I read the book and all the crap was in the book. Oh, and they're just repeating themselves all the time. In a hostile brain like mine, that is not good information. As soon as I can become critical of it, I will spend hours being critical of it. I will become obsessively critical of it. And I will start puncturing holes in it at every opportunity I can because I found the weak spot. I found the weak spot. Now I'm going to go around and tell them how wrong they are. Meeting level, oh, I'll share. Then you load me with some information, like read the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I read the book, and then I was like, oh my God, they're not even quoting the right quote. And I'd go back home and I'd look up pages. Oh, on page blah, blah, blah. Back in those days, 517 was 449. And there's bumper stickers, 449 bumper stickers. Old guys know that. I'd go back and look up the pages. It's not here. I'd go to a meeting. Mother effing, I was not as civil as I am now. Liars. You guys are lying. I looked it up. It's not there. La, 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 la. And now I'm arguing sober because I'm sober for a little bit of time and I'm super humble. And it dawned on me again, those great cloud opening moments of get a sponsor. And I'm going like, sponsor? Me? I should get a sponsor? You guys are making these suggestions all the time. And now after a couple of years, it's dawning on me that you mean me. I'm supposed to get a sponsor. Well, I hadn't tried that before. I didn't drink for a couple of years, but I was still like doing the reading the book for myself, going out, talking like I know something, fitting into Alcoholics Anonymous by throwing the right easy does it's and the live and let lives right at the right time. So people knew I was really working a bitching program. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, I need to get a sponsor. And I'm telling you, when I sat down with a sponsor and read the book Alcoholics Anonymous, that whole book changed. I don't know what was happening, but the stuff that I was reading in the book when I was sitting down with another alcoholic was entirely different than when I did it by myself. As I was going like, oh my God, what's wrong with me? I've been around this long, because by this time I'm like 3 years, 2.5, 3 years, right? And that's some serious time where I come from. And it's like, I had no idea the book was said what the book said. And I'd read it a couple of times by then. Wasn't registering in this alcoholic brain of mine what it meant. And his sponsor's sitting there. My sponsor was like depressed and next to homeless and had 3 or 4 years. And he was sponsoring me so that he could stay sober. And he starts telling me some things about what that book says. And I'm going like, holy moly, there's a lot more meaning here than I was giving it credit for. Because I was still in the mode of, if I didn't drink, I must be doing it right. Rather than if I didn't drink, there's a grace of God. I still thought my sobriety had to do with me. I still thought it was something that I did do or didn't do that was causing me to be sober. I wasn't accepting that there might be this higher power that gave a crap enough about me that regardless of all the things that I did wrong, I was still sober when I could never stay sober before. He's like, and he said, that's evidence. That's evidence of a higher power that you're miserable, insane, crazy, wrong thinking, regardless of that. And he talked to me about sincerity. But you really meant it. I really meant all the things I was thinking and all the things I was saying, and I thought I was right. I really meant it, and I got rewarded for sincerity, not for accuracy. God graced me, kept me sober, and I had no idea what I was doing or what to do, and I thought I did. That part of this sobriety for myself has not changed. It doesn't matter how long I've stayed sober, and I meet with new guys, and I sit down with old guys. Most of the guys I sponsor these days are guys with years. And we go over the book again, and we look for the stuff we're missing. We're looking for the stuff we're missing. Because after a short period of time, what I got to realize is that every time I've read that book, I find stuff that I missed. And that's about as humble as I'm going to be. I'm not going to get much humbler than, I miss some stuff. And I we sit down and we start talking about the things like, you know, the people with like 3 years and what how terrible it gets for them. Because their ego is wrapped around AA and they're still not as spiritual as they probably could be. And they can't tell anybody in AA because we've got to look good for each other all the time. And can't say at the meeting, I got 3 years, I'm not getting this. Because who knows that they're not getting it. I thought I was doing everything right when I wasn't doing anything right. I wasn't lying, I was misdirected. And then 7 years happens again. We don't ever talk about it in the meeting. Though in 7 years, this is going to be funnier than hell. You're going to go crazy. You poor people who get in relationships before your first 15 years, this is going to be a struggle. You're going to think it's about the other person and getting along with them rather than you getting along with you so you're not an asshole. Along with I did it again. So anyway, did I say don't get in a relationship your first 15 years? Yeah, okay, good. Like anybody's going to do that, right? It's so great. So I'm reading the book Alcoholics Anonymous now. Now I'm working the steps, and now I'm like doing the writing. I'm doing the writing, and we're fixing the writing that I was getting wrong and doing it some more. I did my fifth step with a sponsor, with the same guy, because I'm just, I have intimacy issues, and once you get to know me for a little bit, it's like I'm not going to go get to know 500 more people. I'm going to stick with that guy because I don't want to let anybody else know the stuff I'm getting ready to let this guy know. This is not for public viewing. It's just for like it's something I needed to do. And he introduced me to this idea that the reason you do a fifth step is so that I could be humble enough for the Spirit to enter me. It's in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It wasn't so I could remember my patterns and I was going to remember when I went drinking. That won't work. Remembering the horrors of my last drunk is not going to keep me sober. That's in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We will not be able to, with sufficiently enough force, remember the horror of our last debacle that will keep us from the next drink. We're powerless. And I got a whole nother treatment program thing, but I'll stop there. So all the promises there that you're going to get to do, it's like, but the book Alcoholics Anonymous, the only thing I'm going to get here is sober. And then I got to be responsible. The freedom in Alcoholics Anonymous comes with responsibility. And if I was to take responsibility for my alcoholism, I could be free of it by following a few simple directions. So I do my fifth step with a sponsor. We get into that little short reading in the big book of the 6 and 7, right? It says basically like we don't know what we're doing because they only had a couple of years when they wrote that book. They didn't have a bunch of experience of working the steps when they wrote that book. They had like moments. And they you do this thing and the people go like, oh, it didn't say anything about the 6 step. My sponsor starts pointing out to me how some of my defects of character might start showing up a little more acutely. And I might start noticing that I have a few character flaws that I should probably take responsibility for. Some of which I couldn't change even if I wanted to. So this narcissistic working on myself thing wasn't going to help me. I had to have God's help. I had to have God's help. And then I got introduced to the 7-step prayer, where I turned my will and my life over to the care of God. My Creator, you may now have all of me good and bad. Not step 3. Step 3 is just to take care of me and babysit me for a while I do the rest of the work. Step 7 is like, here you go. Because I still want to hold on to these great things that I think are character attributes and be boastful about them. I want to hold on to the good parts of my story so I can have positive affirmations that I can tell you how good I am. Rather, I got to give those to God too, because I don't know how to use those very well either. I can take perfectly good human qualities. I could destroy rooms with them for all the best reasons. That I'm that unmanageable. And so we kept going. I tell you, man, for me, step 9 was it. All of the freedom, all of the joy, all of the ability to accept things that were unacceptable. When I started making amends to other people, man, it was like, yes, it's over. It's over. Because the noise in my head was so much about justification, rationalization, helplessness. I couldn't help it. Hopelessness. It's always going to be this way. And when I started making amends, I could see directly how the Lord's Prayer, which some people still use, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Doing step 9 was me forgiving. It was me being forgiving to others. I was making, and as that was occurring, I became free. I became the guy who could walk around with his head up, straightforward, not only know that I was trustworthy, I didn't have to brag about it anymore. And as a matter of fact, by this time, people came to expect that I was trustworthy. They didn't hesitate in giving me responsibilities. They asked me to show up to things, to do things for them and with them. My life had changed. And all of a sudden, I am the guy that people call on when they don't have other answers for things. It's like, and I'm sitting there noticing this stuff. I'm the guy they're calling on? Wow. But my ego is still tied up into that past, where I want to use my low self-esteem to justify my selfishness and my other misconduct. It's like, but it wasn't working anymore. And I had to accept that God was doing for me what I could not do for myself. That somehow I was becoming that guy. Regardless of where I've been, regardless of what I'd done, I was the guy they were calling. It's like, wow, how does that happen? I prayed for it. That's why, read the prayers. Read the prayers in the books. Read the 11-step prayer. Right? Let me be a channel of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me bring love. And all of a sudden, I'm like the most loving guy in the room. How does that happen? Not because I worked hard on myself and I came around and told everybody my problems all the time. That I put my problems aside and I got into service as it's described to get into service. He's like, sit down with this cat, read the book, see what you thinks, listen to it. Because I tell you, working with newer guys, it's so much fun because their minds aren't polluted with AA. So they have fresh ideas about what all this stuff means. And it's like, wow, I haven't thought of it like that before. Wow, listen to this cat. I was not where he was at when he was that new. And so all you new guys said, please read the book Alcoholics Anonymous and tell us about it. Because after a little while, you know, my mind has gotten pretty prejudiced and closed-minded about other things, which it doesn't say to do in the book. It didn't say come in here and be a know-it-all and a bleeding deacon and stuff. It says keep an open mind. And last year, 3 years ago, because I'm a hostile, belligerent alcoholic with 30 years of sobriety, I had triple bypass open heart surgery because I love bacon. I love bacon. And I don't want a 6-ounce steak. I want a 16-ounce steak. And I'll dream about the 28-ounce steak, thinking that maybe it would be a good try. Maybe I should try that. I know all the health ramifications of that. And I did it for years. And for that, I get to go to triple bypass open heart surgery, not because God was cursing me, but because I am such a hostile, unreconcilable knucklehead that even though I know the sodium in bacon is deadly dangerous, I love bacon and I'll make it about my feelings rather than knowledge. I will take all of the knowledge that I have, I will put it all aside and I'll have an emotion. And I will do whatever I want with that emotion. And you can't judge me for it because it's my emotion, and emotions you can't shame people for. And I almost killed myself. Sober. You know they talk about like gluttony? When you start tipping the scale a little bit around here, I don't know if you guys have done that, but I was teetering over 300 for a while. He's like, oh, this is what 6 and 7 is about. Oh, this is why they use those words. Like, I was a gambling addict, so I lost my home. Took a risk, gambled it away. You think, wow, sober. It's hard to come to meetings and go like, oh no, it was the crisis of 2008 and the crash. It's like, no, I signed some loan papers that said there's going to be a balloon payment coming up, and I gambled it. I took the chance. I couldn't come and say, unfortunate set of circumstances. I said, I gambled it. And I had to move my entire family out of our home. Sober. And I only had enough humility to come here and tell the truth about that. Rather than say, I got caught up in the financial thing. It's like, oh no, they warned me. My realtor guy, mortgage banker, warned me about this money thing. And the bottom could drop out and you could lose everything. And I said, but I want a new Harley. And some computers. Because I was helping people and I wanted to buy some computers so I could help them. So it was all for a good cause. I'm sure God will take care of me. Because of all the good reasons I'm going to make to take this risk. And my spiritual life I had used to justify insane behavior. And not really accept that I was taking a risk. I didn't think I took a risk because I prayed about it. And I decided for myself how God was going to answer that prayer. I didn't wait and see how God was going to answer the prayer. I had to sign some documents so I could get some cash. Greed. Greed. And I've been reading it in the book of in the 12 by 12 for 20 years, and now I understood what it meant. I got so greedy. And I could have the immediate gratification of having all that money to buy cool things that I wanted and look good doing it, by the way. I lost it all. And going to meetings and going, I lost it all because I got greedy. Had a good life. And I risked it all and lost. Pretty exciting to risk it all if you really want to know. You know, there's an adrenaline pump to risking it all, you know, like high-risk sports and all that stuff. It was exciting until it crashed. Like, wow. And I had to take responsibility for that because that's what the steps showed me how to do. How do I take responsibility for the results in my life? If they're not what I want, how do I take responsibility for it? If it's what I want, how do I take responsibility for it? And with that responsibility, I became free. He's like, oh, wow, freedom through responsibility. I think they're like opposing ideas. In the insane mind of me, I think responsibility is a burden. It's like commitment, right? It's like, oh, God, where's the freedom? The freedom is in the commitment. You know how much stuff you don't have to deal with if you're committed to something? If you commit to sobriety, there's a whole bunch of shit you don't have to deal with anymore. Don't have to deal with drug dealers anymore, any of that stuff. Don't have to deal with court. I haven't been to court since I've been sober. Well, not for myself. I got to go for my kids because my sobriety did not save my children. How much time do I got? 2 minutes. God, that's timely. Because if I talk about my kids, I might cry, and I don't want to do that because I don't trust you enough yet. But I got 2 kids who have this disease. One of them's got a couple years sober. The other one is still trying to learn what alcoholism and drug addiction is. They think like I think. If I just say I won't do it, I won't do it. And to walk through that for years as a parent and not overshadow them with my story. You know, I know what you're up to. I was up to the same thing, and rah, rah, all this arrogant, weird shit that just doesn't even deal with the disease at all. My disease has nothing to do with them. They get to work on that crap themselves. They got themselves drunk without me. None of my kids have ever seen me drunk. None of my kids have ever seen me do anything. I took them to meetings. They said, those people are screwed up, Dad. I said, yeah, they are. And I never took them to another meeting. They didn't come to meetings and go like, oh, this is great. Let me listen to a bunch of old people talk about things I can't understand. It was no environment for my children. They wanted to go to the playground. Selfish little kids. So, and dealing with that for a few years. You know, and great things come of being an Alcoholics Anonymous and being able to go to God with all of it. And the great things are, is they found their own way. I didn't have to kill them to take myself out of pain. Because that's what I was thinking. I've got to hurt these kids bad enough so that I don't have to feel the pain of what they're doing. And I had to feel the pain of it. I'm not strong enough to feel the pain of love. I love my kids like endlessly. And I am not strong enough to deal with love. So I need God's help. And what else happens is, you know, I got married. I've been married for 30-something years. And I laugh at people who are in and out of relationships and go, you think being in and out of relationships hard? Try staying in one for 30 years. My wife's here tonight, so I'd like to say that for her personal entertainment. Because it's rough. It's rough to love another person through all of the things that another person goes through. But I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's not about me getting her to love me. It's about me putting me aside to love her, regardless. Regardless of what she does, what she says, how she says it, when she does it, blah, blah. Oh my God, I thought she was put on this earth to torture me. Rather than, oh my God, I married a human being and they act all the same. It's like, how am I going to love this person now? When our kids are hurting themselves and dying and all that stuff, how am I going to love her now when I'm going through so much? Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to put myself aside, ask God for guidance, and go love the other person. And it taught me about step 12. That I don't work the 12th step for me to stay sober. I work the 12th step because I love you. I don't carry the message because for me to stay sober. I carry the message because I love you. God took care of my sobriety. In exchange for that, I have to love you. That's the deal around here. If you're new, that's the good and bad news. It's like, because when I got here, I was this close to never caring again. The hostility that I was practicing was, I just had to convince myself I didn't care. Now it's like, I care. I care. And how am I going to show it in a way that you can receive it? How can I ask God to change me in a way that you can receive the love that I have for you? That's my duty here. Is to be humble enough to let God change me so the love God has for you can flow through me to you. The 11-step prayer. Make me a channel. Not make me an object. Make me a channel so that moments during the day, God can work through me for the benefit of others. I don't know when that time is going to be. I don't get to decide who it's to. I don't get to pick and choose who it's for. But sometimes I can notice it. And what I really love is working with a new guy. And you hear something come out of your mouth when you're telling him this thing about whatever you're reading. And you don't know where it came from, and it's totally brilliant, and it's sharp and shiny, and it's like, oh my God, where did that come from? I know where it came from. God answered the prayer. I asked God to make me a channel, and God did what he said he would do. Answered the prayer through me to the other person. And it is cool when other people's families come up to you and go like, oh, you saved my kid, are you, blah, blah. You go like, I try to let them enjoy that, but I know. If I wasn't the miserable alcoholic that I am, I would never have the humility to let God work through me for the life of another. What else do I want to do with my life? How much more respect do I need? How much more esteem do I need than to realize that God works through me to help other people? Low self-esteem is just self-centeredness. It's just me being self-centered. Because this God is available to anyone and everyone upon their asking and their willingness to do the work. I think I'll stop. Thank you.